This is The Guardian.
Welcome to Weekend, a podcast that helps you switch off from your busy day-to-day and find entertainment and inspiration in the best Guardian and Observer writing from the week. You can either listen to this as one podcast or play each article as individual listens. Just scroll down the description on the podcast page for the timings of what we are featuring. Coming up, Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner, on roots, rough edges, and being ready for power. And how an app sparked a late-life gender transition for author Lucy Sant.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. All episodes out now.
Just a warning, there's a bit of bad language in this episode. Now, Angela Rayner's popular post-bullshit, post-shame candor is bringing out the worst in the Tories. And if Labour gets into government, the deputy leader will be one of the most powerful women in Britain. Bring it on, she says. By Charlotte Edwards. Read by Christine Bottomley. This article touches on the topic of suicide, which some listeners may find upsetting.
Angela Rayner's office in Westminster is part walk-in wardrobe, part sixth-form common room. An inflatable karaoke mic is attached to a bust of Keir Hardie by the fireplace. Glitter shoes line the fleur-de-lis carpet. There are iced donuts, a crystal pint glass, a grinning photo of two freckled schoolboys. I'm reminded of that 2022 craze, bring your whole self to work. Labour's deputy leader, Ange, as she refers to herself, is at the centre, arms raised in greeting like a cheer. She's in Lincoln green, a military-style dress with epaulettes. The Tories accuse me of being in camouflage because I blended in with the colour of all the stuff in Parliament, she roars. Nothing about Rayner blends in. Not only is she 5'10", broad mank, hair the copper of a tarnished coin, but she was raised in abject deprivation on a Stockport council estate, left school with no qualifications, was pregnant at 16, a grandmother by 37. She compliments my bag, thanks her advisor for the tea. Most of us take oat, but Angela always insists on real milk, he told me in the kitchen, and indicates for us to sit. What's the kitten face cushion on the sofa? That's a sensory pillow for MPs who need a bit of love, she says. If they're feeling anxious, they come in here, play with the soft furnishings and have a good rant. If Labour gets elected, Angela Rayner will be one of the most powerful women in Britain. As well as deputy leader, she is Shadow Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities. In her brief are some of the party's most radical pledges, including an end to zero-hour contracts, restoring power to trade unions, and building 1.5 million homes within 5 years. Speculation over a spring election is feverish when we meet, and Labour, still more than 20 points ahead, are on high alert. Rayner's attitude? Bring it on. I think it should be in May. She's unmoved that Jeremy Hunt swiped two of their tax rise pledges for his budget. They've discovered Nom Doms. Who knew, eh? She says. Since Sue Gray has joined the team as chief of staff from Whitehall, we're match fit. We've gone from second division to premiership. We're ready because we've been training for it. You'll get bored of seeing me in the first 100 days of a future Labour government, Rayner says. I'm committed to ensuring I get our housing policies and New Deal for working people over the line very quickly. That sets out a framework which includes repealing some of the Tories' anti-trade union legislation. She scoffs at the suggestion that there will be more strikes. The Tories brought in the most restrictive legislation on trade unions in any European country, yet we've had more strikes than ever. The idea that we're going to make it easier for strikes is completely untrue. Is there a danger Keir Starmer will dilute these plans under pressure from business, the Tory party and the right-wing media? After all, he scrapped their promised £28 billion a year on green projects after Rishi Sunak accused him of risking public finances. That makes me laugh. Of course, some businesses will be frightened by it, like they were when the last Labour government introduced the national minimum wage, and they said lots of businesses will go bankrupt. That never happened. But the idea that Rachel Reeves and Keir are somehow in the business corner and I'm in the worker corner is for the birds. We're all pro-worker, pro-business, and we're all signed up to that. She runs through a whole host of other plans, from new towns to flexi-working and condensing hours. All in the first 100 days. We haven't even touched on levelling up yet, or community cohesion, faith, or local government, she says. Does she plan to sleep? She laughs. The good news is, I've always suffered from insomnia. It's genetic. Me nana didn't sleep. Me dad doesn't, or me eldest son. An average night is 3 or 4 hours. Deputy leader is an elected position in the Labour Party, which means Rayner can't be sacked. Tensions boiled over in May 2021 when she learned from a reporter that Starmer was moving her from the post of party chair and national campaigns coordinator after Labour lost Hartlepool in the by-election. She leaves it for us to imagine what was said during the hours she was locked in an office with Starmer. What we do know is that she emerged with a promotion. Rayner fully accepts that she and Starmer are in striking contrast. He is the restrained former director of public prosecutions, stored as Mr. Darcy in her phone because he was said to be the inspiration for the Bridget Jones character, a technocrat in somber suits. She likes loud footwear, can operate a tow truck and a hoist, and could service your car. She says if I were to record them with a secret camera, sitting on the sofa discussing what they'd seen after a day on the road, their comic interaction would be like Gogglebox. Actually, we kind of complement each other. He smooths off my rough edges, I bring him out of his shell. They are quick to locate each other's blind spots, because we look at things so differently. Is he teasable? Yeah, because I understand the human now. At the beginning, I was a bit like, he probably thought I was a bit overbearing. I probably thought he was a bit quiet. The relationship took some building. It's like when you go to a party, it's all a bit stiff for the first half hour. By the end, everyone's like, yay, love you. That's me and Kia. She quickly adds Rachel Reeves. Because it's me, Kia and Rachel. It's not the duo, it's the trio. Certainly, you could not accuse Rayner of being quiet. She talks in unspooling, multiple-clause sentences. Words are reordered and run again. So at times, I'm faced with a wall of dense talk. She doesn't allow for interruption, riding over my words by raising her voice. The conversational equivalent of a monster truck with bull bars. That said, her use of blunt, simple language is effective. She reads as direct and honest. She says she was always like this. My nana used to say I could talk a glass eye to sleep. Tories, she told this paper last year, can be quite scared of her. They don't know how to interact because they don't often meet people like me and it's almost a bit awkward. Rayner, on the other hand, is unfazed by people. People are my superpower, she says. I just love people. You can't make that up. We discuss her tattoos. She has 4, including a Manchester Bee and Labour's Red Rose. She won't rule out another or more surgery. She told the Financial Times that after losing 6 stone of baby weight in 2010, she'd got a £5,600 loan for a breast uplift. You can't be 30 and have a chest like an 84-year-old granny. Today, she says,
I do not want to grow old gracefully. I never want somebody, when I say I'm a grandma, to not look shocked. This post-bullshit, post-shame candor is perhaps what feels refreshing to voters desperate for change. Her advisor says she's mobbed for selfie requests and people shout compliments wherever she goes. Earlier this month, she was a surprise guest at Letters Live in the Royal Albert Hall in London. The 5,000-seat venue erupted as she stepped up to the podium. She read first a recent letter to the editor of The Guardian about Rishi Sunak, and later one on the topic of fear from the author Shirley Jackson to a fan in 1962. Could all this popularity explain the angry sexism and snobbery from Tory ranks? Remember the bizarre smear that she crossed and uncrossed her legs, basic instinct style, to put them off in the chamber? The derogatory nicknames, Ginger Growler, Slapper Ange. A trip to Glyndebourne as the guest of a violinist from Stockport prompted Dominic Raab to tell the Commons. She talks about working people while sipping champagne listening to opera. She was compared by The Telegraph to Lauren Cooper, Catherine Tate's bolshy, not-bothered teen, and recently deployed by Conservative Party Central Office in fundraising emails to trigger members to donate. Today, she defends herself over an accusation by former Conservative Deputy Chairman Lord Ashcroft in his unauthorised biography, Red Queen, that she has questions to answer over the sale in 2015 of the former council house she bought in 2007. Rayner should have paid capital gains tax on the property, Ashcroft says, because when she married in 2010, her husband Mark Rayner owned another property close by. Rayner says this is completely untrue, that she has taken expert advice and owes nothing. If I had owed any tax, I would have paid it. Did I know the ins and outs of principal private residency and capital gains tax back when I was a home help? Because I was a home help and a single mum when I bought it. No, but I took advice from the estate agents and my solicitor when I sold my property. But Rayner is not infallible. In 2021, she delivered a wincing tirade describing Boris Johnson and his cabinet as homophobic, racist, misogynistic, nasty Etonian scum. Eventually, she apologised. She didn't want to inflame abuse, and anyway, it was not all Tories. She gets on extremely well with Joe Johnson, Boris's brother, and says Michael Gove, her opposite number in Levelling Up, is very competent. Despite her astonishment that he gave back nearly £2 billion of affordable homes grant because he couldn't face down his backbenchers on planning reform. And while a proud socialist, she is clear that first and foremost, she's a pragmatist. Ideology never put food on my table is one of her top lines. Another, we can't fix everything overnight. She has also said she is hardline on law and order and pro-security. A brother served in Iraq. When I ask how Labour will handle the accusation from Tories that Keir doesn't know what a woman is, she says, without acknowledging any shift, yeah, sure, we have biological women and we have trans women and they're both women. One is a biological woman through sex and one is a trans woman who has transitioned. Most of the public can get that. Won't the Tories continue to pelt her for having sat on Jeremy Corbyn's front bench? Well, who knew Rishi Sunak was there when Boris Johnson was partying during lockdown? She retorts. Even got a fixed penalty notice. Who knew he'd been around for the last 14 years of the Conservatives' failure? But never mind. I was just part of the opposition that was putting forward fresh ideas and trying to challenge the government of the day to improve people's lives. Her voice strengthens. I will not apologise for being there for the people of this country who needed an opposition. Nonetheless, she's clear she thought Corbyn indecisive and lacking in leadership skills. What stopped him apologising for anti-Semitism in the party? An inability to see the problem, she says. There were also people around him saying, hang on a minute, you've got to stand up to this. And in his mind, he stood for a movement. I don't think it was to cause harm, just a genuine flaw. Attacks on Rayner come from all corners. George Galloway, the new MP in Rochdale, who campaigned on a pro-Palestine platform, cited her specifically as someone
he wanted his Workers' Party of Britain to oust. Rayner will say only that he has been elected democratically, but when Labour hadn't fielded a candidate. Labour withdrew support from Azzarelli after it emerged he had said that Israeli government had deliberately allowed the deadly Hamas attack on 7th of October. It gave Galloway an open goal. Rayner says Labour have since tightened up vetting of candidates. There is a widespread perception on the left that Labour is still not critical enough of Israel's actions in Gaza. What did Rayner make of the comments by US Vice President Kamala Harris that there should be an immediate ceasefire? Her intervention was really important. What the Labour Party have tried to do is bring about a humanitarian ceasefire for the release of hostages and to make sure aid gets to the Palestinian people, she says. A Labour government wants to play a crucial role in rebuilding Gaza and bringing about the two-state solution. It would recognise a Palestinian state and make sure Israel feels safe and secure because Israel has a right to exist and Palestine has a right to exist. She notices on my flashing phone that my daughter is ringing and insists I take it. Mine always call too. You panic thinking something's wrong and they're like, I was just wondering why Netflix isn't working. Although Rayner is open about the extreme neglect and deprivation she faced growing up, so people can relate to it, she says. She is cautious of what she calls the poor Ange narrative. She doesn't want to sound as if she's peddling victimhood because she had to care for her bipolar mother from the age of 10 or because her mother was illiterate and gave them dog food thinking it was stewing steak. But here's the snag. Her background is her politics. It's what underscores her central belief that it's really hard to fix people once you've broken them. Rayner was born Angela Bowen on the Bridgehall Estate, Stockport, in March 1980, the second of three children. Her mother Lynn was one of 12 kids born to out-of-work parents. Lynn had never been to school. I followed the fare, was how she described her upbringing to a daughter. Beyond the fact that her mum was from Withenshaw, like Marcus Rashford, and her dad from Stockport, Rayner has no idea of her family's background. I don't want to go on who do you think you are. I dread to think who I am. I just think I know what I know. It's worth noting that former Tory Chancellor Sajid Javid's mother was also illiterate, but regularly marched young Sajid to the local library to study. Lynn, by contrast, was in spirals of suicidal despair. For long periods, she was unable to get out of bed. Rayner became her carer, feeding her, washing her, once even sleeping at the end of her bed, in case she did something, she says. The house was a tip. The children were covered in dog fur, tide marks of dirt visible on the skin. Food was sausage with chips, chips with chips. On Sundays, they traipsed 2 miles to their nan's high-rise for a hot bath and to have uniforms washed in her twin tub. We used to play on the old disused railway lines, age 5, and that was 8 streets away from where I lived. I'd be nervous about my 14-year-old going 8 streets away, let alone a 5-year-old. Their father was largely out, sometimes overnight, sometimes having walked out, his mood unpredictable on his return. Rayner remembers the slam of the front door and mimes a frightened gasp, zipping her mouth in fear. As a child, little things are big. Your dad's come home and he's angry. How do you not breathe so they don't see you hiding? She doesn't analyse her parents' relationship. That's for them, she says. But watching her mother's collapse each time her dad left made her feel a byproduct of their relationship. We weren't, like, wanted. I don't really feel like I've ever been loved or needed love because I've never had it in that way. In one family photo, 7-year-old Angela is jutting her chin forward with a determined grin, a tour de force even then. There's the trademark fringe, hair firecracker orange. They used to joke about me being the milkman's because I was the only ginger in the family. I was quite happy with that. She developed weird rituals to cope with a crippling fear of the dark. Do you remember toilets with a pull chain? So loud. I used to go as far as I could with the chain, pull it, and then think, you've got 10 seconds to get back in bed, pull the cover over so that nobody can see you. In the estate hierarchy, their family was the lowest of the low. She would run the gauntlet of bullies on the way to the shop. She badgered friends to stay at theirs for tea. Other kids' parents, tired of feeding her, told her to wait on the curb until their kids were done. I remember one friend moaning, "I've got to eat Sunday dinner again." I was like, "Sunday dinner? That is Christmas for me. Christmas." She was in nightclubs at 14. By 15, she was out all hours, drinking cider, riding buses. As she got older, she began to feel more and more furious with Lynn. Why couldn't she be like other mums? Why couldn't she just get up? Why was she so lazy and selfish? Today, she recognises the debilitating nature of her mother's condition, of the effect of mental illness on a family. She says, "It's like the sun. It's a constant. Everything gravitates around it. It penetrates everything. It sets the environment, the tone. You feel the heat. You either get burnt or you don't." Bowen now lives in supported tenancy. In an interview with ITV in 2020, she said if it wasn't for Angela's decision-making as a child, she probably wouldn't be alive. "I cut my wrists, took tablets. They had to get the police and the ambulance. Angie were at the hospital. They said, 'You can take your mum home now.' And she said, 'Over my dead body, you section her now.'" Raina shifts position on the sofa, turning away from me so that I can see the curl in her spine. She wasn't the first of her cohort to get pregnant, but at 16 she was the youngest to keep the baby. She's described her boyfriend, 19-year-old Neil Batty, as 20 B&H and a Ford Fiesta. But she wants to be clear about one thing. It was her first time. "I've never gone into detail, but when you lose your virginity, the last thing you're thinking is, 'Hey, where's your contraception?' You should be thinking that. I wasn't." "This matters," she says, "because I'm not promiscuous. I was very aware of what people thought of me when I was 16. She has no problem with other people having multiple partners, she adds hastily, "but I felt people saw me as dirty. Actually, I've pretty much always been in good, solid relationships." She was showing a bit when she sat at GCSE, she says, then ballooned. Returning from school one day, her 13-year-old sister saw her sitting on the stairs and was horrified. "And you're putting me off having children. You've literally took up the whole staircase." Raina makes a round shape with her arms. "I'd gone from like this stick insect to this." Throughout the pregnancy, she told herself that she was going to be a good mum, the opposite of her own. At 34 weeks, her back began hurting, and I just thought, that's how it is. The pain persisted for 2 days. By the time she realised she was in labour, her blood pressure was 200 and something over 100 and something. Stepping Hill Hospital in Stockport was known locally as Stepping Hill, Step Out Dead. A joke until one of the nurses was putting saline into drips and killing everyone, she says. When she arrived on the maternity ward with dangerous hypertension, Raina was very scared. The midwife took one look and said, "My daughter's your age. Have you done your GCSEs?" Raina says it felt so loaded. She vomited after gas and air, then felt too self-conscious to ask for more. "I decided to grin and bear it. I didn't want to do it wrong. I didn't have much pain relief at all." She didn't see herself as a child. "I thought I was an adult. 10 men, like. I know how to look after myself." But I was a child. Her son, Ryan, is now 27. She points at the photo of her two youngest from a marriage to Mark Raina. Charlie will turn 16 next month and Jimmy is 14. There they are, the little cuties. I call them pampered pooches. They're both over 6 foot now. After Ryan was born, Raina's life changed. She lived for a while with Batty, working first washing pots, then overnights in palliative care. She took her MVQ level 2 in social care, learned British Sign Language, passed level 2 in counselling and volunteered for the Samaritans at 18. "I'd seen the pain people go through," she says. She also took evening classes in cookery. "I can bake, which is more than my mum could do. I don't just throw things in a deep fat fryer. I don't own a deep fat fryer. I could do you a good dal, which is hard, bear in mind." Her work in the care sector introduced her to the trade union Unison and from there to politics. She was elected as the MP for Ashton-under-Lyne in 2015 and within a year was on the front bench as the Shadow Minister for Education. I ask how she would describe her intelligence and she says, My capacity to learn is as good as anybody else's. The notion that there are people out there today who don't have what she had in the late 90s is devastating to her. During the Oldham by-election in 2015, she saw baby food and nappies laid out at a food bank. I went into the toilets and had a bit of a cry. The idea that I'd have had to go and ask for food and nappies, I completely get how that could dehumanise and demoralise a parent who's trying their best. If you've never been in that situation, it's hard to understand. I've heard ministers say it's a lifestyle choice. It isn't. She sees Tony Blair's New Labour as having laid, with income support, tax credits and Sure Start, the stepping stones that led her out of the chaos of a dysfunctional family. She recognises both that her mother was the product of long-term deprivation and that the consequent neglect in her own childhood will haunt her entire life. She knows echoes will be felt by her own children. This is why she bangs on about Sure Start. It was the setting in which she was able to see mothers properly engaging with their babies, playing with them, encouraging them. She realised with a thump the complete absence of this in her own childhood and what that meant. Your childhood shapes who you are, she says. For me, becoming Deputy Prime Minister is about what I can achieve to unlock the potential of people like me. I feel pressure to ensure people don't get that knocked out of them. Too often she meets young girls who say, I couldn't do what you're doing, Ange. But they could, because they're inspirational and they're strong. She tells them, even though the system feels against you, you can do it. There have been other challenges since. Charlie, who is about to take his GCSEs, was born at 23 weeks, weighing 465 grams. He is epileptic and registered blind. Four times they wanted to switch off the machine, she says. Nonetheless, when an MP tried to use his case as a reason to reduce the 24-week abortion limit, I was upset. I don't think people should use my example to make a decision one way or another. She and her ex-husband are still best friends, despite separating in 2020. Last year, she split from Sam Tarry, the former Labour MP, and Shadow Transport Minister, who lost the whip in 2022 for joining rail workers on the picket line in contravention of a ban by Starmer. Rayner says, I've been incredibly lucky because all my relationships have been very good ones, even when we've parted. I have a very constructive relationship with all my exes, and I can name all of them as well. In 2017, Ryan had a daughter of his own. I said, you've made me a grandma at 37. He said, Mum, there's a reason you're a grandma at 37. I'm not the problem. I'm 21. Might her busyness, her piling up of responsibilities, her 3 to 4 hours sleep a night also be avoidance of uncomfortable feelings from her past? Quite possibly. I do wonder what being on the trajectory the other way will do to me, she says, meaning when her career in politics takes a downwards turn. You can't go through the childhood I went through and not have any fallout from it, she says. She's happy to admit she has issues. She veers away from questions about therapy, but afterwards her advisor tells me she's talked about the odd bad day. Hippo days, she calls them, when she can't face getting dressed or applying makeup. If I wanted to psychoanalyse myself, I might ask, why am I never content? If you look at my career, at what I've done, I've been incredibly successful, but I'm not content. I want to achieve so much more.
That was Angela Rayner on roots, rough edges and being ready for power. You Can't Go Through the Childhood I Had and Not Have Any Fallout by Charlotte Edwards. Read by Christine Bottomley. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this piece, we've included details of helplines you can contact on the episode page at theguardian.com. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back with the second half of this episode in a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. it'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Welcome back to Weekend. Next, in an extract from her memoir, author Lucy Sont reveals how she lived with the feeling of being the wrong gender into her 60s when a smartphone app gave her the inspiration to take action. Read by Lydia Parker.
The dam burst on 16th of February when I downloaded FaceApp for a laugh. I had tried the application a few years earlier, but something had gone wrong, and it had returned a badly botched image. But I had a new phone, and I was curious. The gender-swapping feature was the whole point for me, and the first picture I passed through it was the one I had tried before. This time, it gave me a full-face portrait of a woman in midlife. Strong, healthy, clean living. She also had lovely flowing chestnut hair and a very subtle makeup job. And her face was mine. No question about it. Nose, mouth, eyes, brow, chin. She was me. When I saw her, I felt something liquefy in the core of my body. I trembled from my shoulders to my crotch. I guessed that I had at last met my reckoning. Very soon, I was feeding every portrait and snapshot and ID card picture I possessed of myself into the magic gender portal. The first archival picture I tried, contemporaneous with my first memory of staring into a mirror and arranging my hair and expression to look like a girl, was an anxious, awkward studio portrait of a tween. The transformed result was a revelation, a happy little girl. Apart from her long black hair, very little had been done to transform Luke into Lucy. The biggest difference was how much more relaxed she looked. And so it generally went. I was having a much better time as a girl in that parallel life. I passed every era through the machine, experiencing one shock of recognition after another. That's exactly who I would have been. The app weirdly seemed to guess what my hairstyle and fashion choices would have been in those years. And the less altered the images were, the deeper they plunged a dagger into my heart. That could have been me. 50 years were underwater, and I'd never get them back. My high school graduation portrait became an impossibly delicate almond-eyed fawn. Age 17 was indeed the summit of my beauty, which is probably why my male incubus immediately grew a beard. 10 or 12 years later, there are regrettably few photos of me in my 20s. I've always been camera shy. I am a Lower East Side post-punk radical lesbian feminist with a Dutch boy bob and a pout. Here I am at a Sports Illustrated junket in Arizona, age 33, looking demure in a white sweater over a red polka dot dress. There are many reasons why I repressed my lifelong desire to be a woman. It was, first of all, impossible. My parents would have called a priest and had me committed to some monastery, and the culture was far from prepared, of course. I knew about Christine Jorgensen, the first person widely known in the U.S. for having gender reassignment therapy, when I was fairly young, but she seemed to be an isolated case. Mostly what you came across were vile jokes from Las Vegas comedians, and the occasional titillating tabloid story. I kept searching for images or stories of girls like me, without much luck. Over the years, I consumed an impressive amount of material on transgender matters, from clinical studies to personal accounts to journalistic exposés to porn. Not much of the porn, though. It grossed me out. I researched the subject as deeply as I did any of my books, but my notes all had to be kept in my head. I immediately disposed of all materials because I was terrified of being seen. Until browsers made anonymous searching possible, I wiped the search memory on my computer every day. Why, you may ask, did I feel it necessary to go to such lengths? The short answer is because my mother regularly raided my room, reading anything in my handwriting and vetting all printed matter for anything that might even remotely allude to sex. I extended that caution to my friends, most of whom would surely have been sympathetic, because of the notion I long possessed that women would be disgusted and repelled by my transgender identity. Where did I get that one? It may be because, until I was in my late teens, I didn't know many women, as an only child of isolated immigrants, and I didn't have a female friend until I was 17. Needless to say, I was awful at sex. I did not know how to act like a man in bed. I wanted to see myself as a woman in the act of love, but I also had to repress the desire while simultaneously trying earnestly to please my partner, because I almost never slept with anyone I didn't love, at least at first. I was not at all attracted to men, and I spent enough time in gay environs in the 70s to be sure of that. At puberty and afterwards, I was uncertain how to construct a masculine identity. I hated sports and dick jokes and beer chugging and the way men talked about women. My idea of hell was an evening with a bunch of guys. Over the years, from force of necessity, I created a male persona that was saturnine, cerebral, a bit remote, a bit owlish, possibly quirky, coming very close to asexual despite my best intentions. Another reason for my repression was my sense that if I changed my gender, it would obliterate every other thing I wanted to do in my life. I wanted to be a significant writer, and I did not want to be stuffed into a category. If I were transgender, that fact would be the only thing anyone knew about me. Over the years, transgender people became gradually more visible in the media, and the coverage became a little bit less snide. I lived in New York City, so I saw transgender people often. I was close for a while to the photographer Nan Golden, who would have been certain to understand my story, but I never breathed a word. I would hear rumors that this or that person dressed up, and I would be forever ill at ease in their presence as a result. From envy, of course. My office in the late 80s and early 90s was a block from Tompkins Square Park in the East Village, but I never so much as peeked in at Wigstock, the annual Labor Day drag festival that took place there. It was also half a block from the Pyramid Club, the center of New York's drag scene at the time, but I never went there either. In those days, the club had a black menu board on the sidewalk outside that read, "Drink and be merry." I trembled every time I passed it. I was terrified of finding myself confronted by what I am confronting now. I wanted, with every particle of my being, to be a woman. And that thought was pasted to my windshield. And yet, I looked through it, having trained myself to do so. Now that the floodgates have opened, I am consumed by the thought in a new way. When I uploaded my first picture to FaceApp, I felt liquid and melting in the core of my body. Now, I feel a column of fire. That should not, however, imply a steely resolve. The idea of transitioning is endlessly seductive and endlessly terrifying. I take at least one selfie every day and transform it, and it feels as though the pictures are becoming ever more plausible. With a bit of makeup, a course of estrogen, and a really nice wig, I could look exactly like that. Maybe. But will the fact that I can't grow my own hair make me feel like a fake forever? And I am soon to turn 67. What if I look like a grotesque? Or merely pathetic? It's a vast decision, with the power to affect every aspect of my life. Would I inadvertently destroy important things in my life as a consequence? I keep wanting to be forced to transition by some circumstance. Maybe my therapist telling me that it is crucial for my sanity. Anyway, I'm starting here, by writing it down, something I've never done before, and by sending it to a very few people whom I trust and who I think will understand. My name is Lucy Marie Sant, only one letter added to my dead name. 26th of February, 2021. That was written from within a whirlwind. I am astonished anew every time I consider the chronology. The first FaceApp manifestation occurred on the 16th of February. 10 days later, I came out to my therapist, Dr. G, who didn't blink, but merely said she thought transitioning made sense and was a good idea. The following evening, after I'd written the letter, I came out to my partner, Mimi, which was the single most difficult thing of them all. And the day after that, I came out to my son, Raphael. The fortification of secrets I'd spent nearly 60 years building and reinforcing had crumbled to dust in a little over a week. The reaction was immediate. Emails, phone calls, texts. Everyone was nice, although there was a range. There was unexpected but not surprising, and surprised, but not surprised, and shocking, but not, at one end. And at the other were a few people who reacted as if they'd been hit by a train while they were looking the other way. Those tended mainly to be guys who, over the course of many years' friendship, had come to think of me as a sort of mirror or alter ego. So reevaluating me meant having to reevaluate themselves. Everybody on the not-surprised end was female, as were the three persons who wrote to say they had happy tears in their eyes as they read my letter. I was prepared for some kind of pushback, softly and judiciously expressed, of course, but it never really came, then or later. Most responses were, "Yay! Go for it! You do you!" So now, here I am, just shy of 18 months of hormone replacement therapy at this writing. I am legally Lucy, certified female, out to every single person in my life, however remote. I'm totally normal, the same person as ever, while also quite different. I'm socially at ease as never before. I've been stared at plenty, but have faced zero aggression because I don't represent a threat. I'm old, white, and reasonably privileged. I can honestly say that I'm happy in a way I've never been before. I am finally inhabiting myself, the shadow me once hidden under the floorboards. I actually feel free of the neuroses that plagued me forever. I can and will, of course, be sad, for many reasons, but depression is at least at bay for now. I naturally wish I could have transitioned in my teens or my 20s or any age earlier than mine. But there are compensations. Being left in peace. Being able to nestle my changes into a life that was already structured, having outlived all the censorious elders. I genuinely like who I am. I'm turning out better than I imagined, or feared. I'm more conscious of others, and I find it far easier to bring up emotional matters with them. Often, in varied circumstances, I experience a kind of serenity, a general rightness with the world. I don't hate myself anymore. I'm no longer apologetic for my very existence. I walk with pride, I feel grateful to whatever force cracked my egg before it was too late. I was saved from drowning.
That was, I was having a much better time as a girl in that parallel life. How an app sparked a late life gender transition by Lucy Somt. Read by Lydia Parker. This is an edited extract from I Heard Her Call My Name, a memoir of transition by Lucy Somt. To support The Guardian and Observer, order your copy at guardianbookshop.com, also available as an audiobook. Before you go, we think you should check out our new series on artificial intelligence. It's called Black Box, and each episode follows a different story. The final episode of the series is asking, could AI be the end of humanity? Not necessarily. Search and subscribe to Black Box wherever you get your podcasts. That's all from us. This has been Weekend, a Guardian podcast. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to like, subscribe to, and rate the podcast. Maybe even leave us a nice review, or let us know what you want to hear more of. Just search for Weekend wherever you get your podcasts. This week's articles are read by Christine Bottomley and Lydia Parker, and presented by me, Savannah Oyode-Greaves. This episode was produced by Rachel Porter. The executive producer is Ellie Bury. Join us again next Saturday. Thanks for listening.
This is The Guardian.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.